We're going to begin with something light and then get a bit heavier. This is out of Sports Illustrated. My favorite writer in Sports Illustrated is a guy named Gary Smith. He wrote an article on a very interesting soccer team that was formed by a woman, and this soccer team is composed of refugees, refugee children from all over the world. And they operate out of, I think it's Virginia, somewhere around Washington, D.C. Anyhow, this is a little vignette from that. They call themselves the Fuggies, as from refugees, Fuggies. The Fuggies had never stayed in a hotel before. Even players whose mother worked as chambermaids didn't quite understand the concept. Their coach braced as if for a tsunami as they raced with their plastic Kroger grocery bags stuffed with clothes and piled in, four to a room, on the eve of their first weekend road tournament. A hotel, she explained to them, is a place where a traveler stays for a night or two, then moves on and some other traveler takes his place. But someone has to come in and clean the room so the next traveler has a nice place to sleep. Someone just like your mom's. Now they understood what staying in a hotel meant. It meant that the next two mornings, every one of their rooms was spotless, every towel folded and returned to its rack, every bed made without a wrinkle, because it might make life just a little easier for some exhausted immigrant woman, just like their mother. Sports occasionally offers some wonderful vignettes into life. Okay, my commentary for today, September 24th. Rabble-rousing shows are now archived and can be heard at your convenience 24/7. Tell your friends to go to KVMR homepage, and then in the right-hand column, click on Program Schedule. Then click on the program page for Rabble Rousing with Chamberlain. Past shows will be listed there. First item. Is anyone else amazed by the money and energy being spent over Proposition 8, the issue of whether legal marriage should be limited to people with differing genitals, or open to anyone who wants to call themselves married? I'm astounded. The world is crashing down around them, and these folks have their knickers in a knot and are spending millions to oppose other people wanting the legal rights of marriage. Why? Why do they care? No one's going to force them to marry someone of their own sex. Why do they care if others want to do so? Is this a weird country or what? Okay, enough on Sarah Palin. We got bigger fish to fry. This financial crisis that corporate media is finally beginning to recognize is the news item of our time. I realize it might be a bit odd to quote an astrologer on her financial meltdown, but I find her words relevant, and coming from a slightly different perspective. See how you feel. Here's the take from thecosmicpath.com. A bit of history is in order. Pluto is about to go into Capricorn, the sign of government, banks, big business, financial institutions, and corporations. When Pluto went into Scorpio in 1985, the rest of us found out about AIDS. AIDS had been going on for quite a while, killing lots of people while no one paid much attention. When Pluto went into Sagittarius in 1995, the rest of us found out about the pedophile Catholic Church priest scandal. Again, the situation had been going on for a good long while, but the rest of us finally noticed and went, wow. In both situations, the powers in charge were able to do something about it, but chose not to address the problem until they got way, way out of hand. Essentially, the HIV virus had managed to spread all over the place, and thousands of children had been molested before the collective us said we have to do something to stop this. Now, as Pluto gets ready to go into Capricorn, the rest of us will finally find out about the structural foundation problems of the corporations, banks, and government, due to lack of regulation starting back in the Reagan years. Unitary executive power became the key word as the Republicans began dismantling checks and balances all over the place. It is time for our wow moment about Pluto going into Capricorn. We've already seen some early deaths of Capricorn entities due to lack of regulations. Enron, the dot-com collapse, the savings and loan collapse in the late 80s. Our GOP presidential candidate John McCain was part of the savings and loan mess, as a member of the Keating Five. As a result, McCain, Mr. Deregulator, was sanctioned by the Senate for his bad behavior. Deregulation and consolidation of power into the hands of a very few has been going on for quite a while now. Now, as Pluto goes into Capricorn, the chickens will come home to roost. There's always the big collapse first, when it seems really, really bad, as Pluto enters a new sign, and we all go, whoa, and completely freak out and feel threatened. I can remember friends of mine worrying about whether mosquitoes carried the HIV virus. The bulk of the financial collapse will happen between August 2008 and May 2009. The big problem will happen when the highly leveraged hedge funds start to unwind. The hedge funds will unwind and the market will collapse. We'll be calling it the Greater Depression. We can expect the fall to be when most of the collapse happens. However, we won't know how bad or how far until May of 2009. Then we get to roll around in the muck for a while, 3 to 5 years. Then we figure out how to work with it. Then it starts to get better. See, folks, the robbery's already happened. They already have the money. The U.S. government is like a hollowed-out shell. We are the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. We owe everybody. Just like when Pluto went into Scorpio, people were infected by HIV a while before, and the kids were molested even earlier. The robbery we're just finding out about took place a while ago. They have the money. They've been stealing it, or taking it, if you will, as it was all perfectly legal, for quite a while now. The problem is like musical chairs. There are an ever-decreasing amount of chairs as the music stops. The music has stopped. The game is over. So what to do? Call your congressperson and senators and complain. We need Bush's tax cuts repealed to begin to even partially pay for this bailout. We need a tax increase on the folks who earn over $100,000. Most of the Wall Street is included in that pile. Repeal the tax cuts for very wealthy passed on during the Bush administration's watch. This is a Republican mess. The Republicans need to get credit for the tax hit we're each going to take. 2. Tell us our share. We need to know what we're each on the hook for. My estimate is $4,000 to $6,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. Like the $400 per day we're each spending in Iraq. We need to start taking dollars and cents. We need to start talking dollars and cents instead of these big numbers that no one can wrap their head around. If you wrote a check every month for your share of the war, you'd be paying attention. 3. Nationalize the suckers. We don't have universal health care, but folks who already run off with the money are going to get even more of our money. Open the checkbook even wider. All of the employees, including the bosses of any firm applying for this money, should get civil service grade level pay and civil service pay until they can buy their freedom. If they don't like it, let them find new jobs. Remember, the part they don't tell you is that the money doesn't just disappear like magic overnight. Money is a physical entity. It went someplace. Someone or someone's took the money off the table. They took it off the table and put it in their pockets. Some of these yahoos have been paying themselves billions in annual salaries. How much do you make? $40,000? $60,000? Maybe even $125,000? That money they paid themselves was actually your money. Now they want even more money? More taxpayer money? I don't think they deserve any more money, do you? And maybe they can start by emptying their pockets before they walk out the door. That was the woman who writes for thecosmicpath.com. Next item. Like I said before, the financial meltdown, and especially the government's plan to, quote, fix it, is the news story. Everything else pales by comparison. Remember David Icke? He was a proponent of the theory that the elitists who control everything that matters have a simple strategy. It consists of creating a problem, then offering a solution to that problem that oh so conveniently benefits the creators of that problem. If you doubt this theory, please recall how the Oklahoma City bombing resulted in Congress passing a series of legislation they'd formerly balked at passing, legislation that took away some of our basic civil rights. Now think of the World Trade Center and Pentagon bombings, and the result was USA Patriot Act, Military Commissions Act, and other legislation taking away more of our rights and consolidating more power to the executive branch of what once was our government. Isn't it curious who always benefits from national tragedies? With this firmly in mind, let's look at the solution proposed by government and quasi-government officials, such as Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson and Chairman of the Federal Reserve Ben Bernanke. Once you strip off the BS, who does this latest alleged solution benefit? Wall Street investment companies and their executives, giant insurance corporations, and international bankers. Who does it harm? Ordinary people. Now that you perceive that, the next logical step is the nasty one. Is this economic meltdown the result of stupid and rapacious decisions by greedy corporate executives and money managers? Or is this all part of a grand plan to further enslave the world's peoples? Is this Chamba and many others beginning to suspect that here is one more conspiracy theory that just might be fact and not theory? Think about it. Look at the result. If Paulson's solution is agreed upon by our bought and paid for and essentially traitorous Congress, the government will not only continue to print money, lots and lots of it, out of thin air with absolutely nothing of real value to back it, but they will then give it to giant banking and investment conglomerates. They, not we, select, with absolutely no oversight or control whatsoever. If someone proposed such a setup for a business you owned, you'd laugh them out of your office. Once one sees this scam for what it is, this proposed solution is outrageous. Okay, today I'm going to depart from my usual practice of offering articles from a variety of sources and begin by featuring articles or essays from a single source. I came across opednews.com, which seems to be a website that offers a forum for members to submit essays. I'll offer you a sampling. The first is by Bruce K. Gagnon. He puts it pretty simply, revolution for the rich. We once had free enterprise, every man for himself, but the empire has at last gone and dumped capitalism. Socialism has now taken hold in the USA. At least for the rich it has. Yes, we now have socialism for the rich in America and capitalism for everyone else. The old saw that business had to make it on his own is now history. Start a bank, and if it's nearing collapse, no problem, the government will bail you out. Lost your job because the corporation is closing the plant and moving overseas where cheaper labor can be found? Tough luck, Jack. You're on your own. It's called a revolution. You wanted revolution? Well, you got it. Revolution for the rich. Aye, it's a return of feudalism. Back to the days of the lords and masters, and the serfs in their crumbling villages at the bottom of the hill. Feudalism, the 21st century variety. But this time every peasant gets a car and a TV. That's if you can afford to put the gas in it or pay the cable bill. So just keep your mouth shut and get in line. Remember, if we don't treat the rich with respect, they won't invest their money and create jobs for us. All hail the lords of Wall Street. Bow to the masters of disaster. On your knees, peasants. The next one is by Joan Brunwasser. It's titled, Demand That the Bailout Legislation Be Rejected. We're witnessing a banker's coup d'etat. In the name of saving the economy from a crisis created by their own greed and immense profits, Bush and the biggest bankers have taken a country and a people hostage. Give us your money and tear up what's left of your Constitution, or we'll sink your economy, is the message from Wall Street and the Bush administration. Give us the power and money we demand, or you'll be left jobless from a new economic depression. Under the pretext of the banking crisis, the Bush administration is changing the way the country operates. This is not simply taking trillions of dollars from the people and giving it to the richest bankers to do with what they see fit. Congress is poised to vote to give the executive branch of government, and specifically the White House's political appointees in the Treasury Department, the absolute right to take our money and give it to domestic and foreign banks and corporations without any oversight of elected officials, from the courts or from the people. The new legislation states, quote, decisions by the Secretary of the Treasury pursuant to the authority of this act are non-reviewable and committed to agency discretion and may not be reviewed by any court of law or any administrative agency. Close quote. The legislation allows the Treasury Department to appoint the same bankers who created the crises to administer and dictate the use of trillions of our tax dollars. We will not stand by and let the Bush administration formalize its vision of a government of, by, and for the richest bankers. The new system institutionalizes theft on a grand scale. Lehman Brothers bankers will receive $2.5 billion in bonuses after the company went bankrupt last week. But the new dictatorial authority under the White House and the Treasury Department has ruled out any relief for the millions of working families who are being foreclosed on. We lived in a $15 trillion annual economy. Instead of taking our tax dollars and giving it to the already rich and powerful, these funds should be used to provide for decent-paying jobs, affordable housing, health care, and a good education for our children. There is another way. Now is the time to hear the voice of the people. A spineless Congress authorized Bush's illegal war in Iraq and rubber-stamped the Patriot Act. Now they're being herded like sheep again to give the White House and Wall Street dictatorial control over the people's money. I'm not sure who posted the next article. It's also from opednews.com. There was a Bill Maher segment on TV. In it, Naomi Klein argues that by transferring Wall Street's gambling debt to Main Street, what she calls crybaby capitalism, the shock doctrine will come into play. Quote, "They've moved the disaster from Wall Street to Main Street by accepting those debts, but the bomb is yet to detonate. The bomb is the debt that has now been transferred to the taxpayers." So it detonates when, if John McCain becomes president in the midst of an economic crisis and says, "Look, we're in trouble. We got a disaster on our hands. We have to privatize Social Security. We can't afford health care. We can't afford food stamps. We need more deregulation, more privatization." You know the thesis of the shock doctrine is that you need a disaster to rationalize pushing through these very unpopular policies. So the real disaster has yet to come. The real disaster is the debt that's going to explode on the American taxpayers. And then they do economic shock therapy. Andrew Sullivan, author of The Conservative Soul and writer for TheAtlantic.com, argues with her unsuccessfully. Klein retorts with, "This is socialism for the rich. Look, if we're socializing things, let's nationalize something profitable. Let's go for Exxon. They're socializing junk." The shock doctrine is already beginning, according to Jason Limkins. The dirty secret of the bailout, 32 words that none dare utter. Consolidation of power in the Treasury Department is written into Section 8 of the new bill to bail out Wall Street. A critical and radical component of the bailout package proposed by the Bush administration has thus far failed to garner the serious attention of anyone in the press. Section 8, which ironically reminds one of the popular name of the portion of the 1937 Housing Act that paved the way for subsidized affordable housing. Section 8 of this legislation is just a single sentence of 32 words, but it represents a significant consolidation of power and an abdication of oversight authority that's so flat out astounding it ought to set one's hair on fire. It reads in its entirety, and I'll read it to you again, because these 32 words are critical to our nation's future. "Decisions by the Secretary, pursuant to the authority of this Act, are non-reviewable and committed to agency discretion and may not be reviewed by any court of law or any administrative agency." In short, the so-called mother of all bailouts, which will transfer $700 billion taxpayer dollars to purchase the distressed assets of several failed financial institutions, will be conducted in a manner unchallengeable by courts and ungovernable by the people's duly sworn representatives. All decision-making power will be consolidated into the executive branch, who, we remind you, will have the incentive to act upon this privilege as quickly as possible before they leave office. The measure will run up the budget deficit by a significant amount, with no guarantee of recouping the outlay and no fundamental means of holding those who fail to do so accountable. Is this starting to sound familiar? Robert Kuttner cuts through much of the gloss in an article in today's American Prospect. The deal proposed by Paulson is nothing short of outrageous. It includes no oversight of his own closed-door operations. It merely gives congressional blessing and funding to what he has already been doing ad hoc. He plans to retain Wall Street firms as advisors to decide just how to cut deals to value and mop up Wall Street's dubious paper. There are to be no limits on executive compensation for the firms that get relief, and no equity share for the government in exchange for this massive infusion of capital. Both Obama and McCain have opposed the provision, denying any judicial review of decisions made by Paulson, a provision that evokes the Bush administration's suspension of normal constitutional safeguards in its conduct of foreign policy and national security. Limkin points out widespread lack of media attention on this dangerous bill. One cannot overstate this. Section 8 is a singularly transformative sentence of economic policy. It transfers a significant amount of power to the executive branch while walling off any avenue for oversight and offering no guarantees in return. And if the Democrats end up content with winning a few slight concessions, they risk not putting a stop payment on the real blank check, the one in which they allow the erosion of their own powers. Over in the Senate, Christopher Dodd has proposed a bailout legislation of his own, which critically calls for, quote, an oversight board that not only includes the chairman of the Federal Reserve and the SEC, but congressionally appointed non-governmental officials. and would require the president to appoint an independent inspector general to investigate the Treasury asset program. In Dowd's legislation, Section 8 is effectively stripped from the bill. Nevertheless, the fact that Section 8 of the Paulson plan seems to strike few as a de facto deal breaker can and should astound. But if we make it through this week with nobody in the press specifically informing the public about the implications of this single sentence, in the middle of a complicated bill, in the middle of a complicated time, then, right there, you have the single largest media failure of the year. My comment. I don't want to issue a call to action or tell you what to do. But if you don't immediately contact your elected representatives, write your letters to editors, and do whatever else you can to voice your feelings, pro or con, on this proposed bailout of Wall Street and the investment houses, with no oversight by your elected representatives, you may soon wake up in a very different America than you'd imagined. Sleep through this one, and you may wish you'd remained asleep. The time is 12:29. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting from Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamberlain. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing, and we have a caller. Caller, you're live on the air.
Hey, Chamba, there used to be another term for Section 8. I think it was sometime between before 5250 came around or whatever that one is.
Yeah.
So you were crazy. That was Section 8. Anybody would vote for that. It is crazy.
Oh, very good point. Well, if we allow this to happen, I think we deserve a Section 8.
There we go.
All right.
See you later.
Thanks for the call. Okay. We got another caller. Caller, you're live on the air. Caller, you're live on the air. Caller? I guess it might be another one of those people that didn't want to be on the air. All right. I'm going to read you a fairly lengthy essay. It's called A Modest Proposal. It's by Robert Wolfe. He lives on and writes from the Big Island of Hawaii. And he's an elderly gentleman. He's kind of a recluse, and he's had an interesting life. And I think you might enjoy this. It's quite lengthy, but I think it's worth the read. Robert Wolfe. We live in a time of lies. The media has taught us that the slide from advertising to propaganda is really just a matter of meaningless words. The media also demonstrated that a lie said with conviction and repeated a few times becomes accepted fact. We the people accept that where there's smoke, there must be fire. Oh, yeah? And yet we humans are more confused than ever. We drown in the lies from the right and the left, up and down and sideways. Nobody knows what to believe anymore. So we seek refuge in the voices of the people who we think are like us, or pretty, or rich, or whatever. As the financial system that blossomed the first 8 years of this century, based on its fictitious about illusions, greed, and confusion, we don't know who we are anymore. Pollsters talk about demographics, by which they mean slices of the total population that are supposed to think alike have the same prejudices and preferences. I have no idea what demography I fit in. Do you? My skin is called white, although it's very visibly red. Not even pink, but bright red. My parents were Dutch, my mother Mennonite, my father racially a Jew, but religiously nothing. I grew up in a very small town in Indonesia. All my friends were shades of brown. From the light beige of boys and girls who had a Chinese forefather or mother, to dark brown of kids who had ancestors from one of the dozens of tribes living in the interior of Sumatra. I was often the only, quote, white, so spent many hours of sunlight as I could in the sun. I became as brown as my friends. Now I pay for that with about all the skin diseases there are. Once on a plane from Singapore to London, I sat next to a very beautiful Chinese woman, from Singapore, I assumed. My assumption was wrong. Her speech was high Oxford British, born and raised in England. This had been her first trip to see the Orient. She said, I feel like I'm white and a yellow skin. I laughed because I was going to say I have a white skin but a brown soul. Now many years later, having lived in several countries and getting to know people all over the world, traveling a few million miles, this is what I discovered. We're everywhere. Mixed people, racially mixed, culturally mixed, mixed up. Or to say it another way, there are very few pure anything people left in the world. That's what all of us are by now, mixed. Pure white or a minority in the world and probably in this country, if we are honest about our ancestry. I want to add another we, meaning you and I and everyone else in a larger demography. Like we humans, regardless of skin color, shape of eye, color and kind of hair, political ideas, customs, religion, age, gender, ethnicity, and other new and useless words. We confuse ourselves when we try to be nice and are careful to say African American, Eskimo American, Latin American, or am I now supposed to say Latino? How about Estonian American, Burkina Faso American? All it does is emphasize differences our culture tells us to be aware of. The big things today are the collapse of banks. Some are rescued or bought by our government. Where do they get the money? I guess they print it. Some banks are bought up by other banks. The stock market goes up one day, down the next. We're all trying to figure out what is happening. I've heard and read dozens of explanations of how subprime, that means not quite absolutely first class, mortgages, sold by greedy salesmen to people who could not possibly pay the mortgage for an overvalued house, caused all of this. But of course there's a whole system behind that. It seems that those subprime mortgages were then mixed in with good mortgages, then cut up in pieces and sold. The theory being that, yeah, there may be one or two, perhaps doubtful mortgages, but the good mortgages will cover them. Like, if you have rotten food, you mix it in with good food, and then can it in small cans, and chances are that a buyer will get mostly good food. And then I read somewhere else that really what drives the whole, now global, financial system is based on credit, or liquidity, and something this writer called valuation. Here's how I understand what he wrote. You buy an idea, or a plan to do something, or something that does not exist yet, but probably will, all with borrowed money. Then you turn right around and sell that non-existent yet idea to someone else, who probably also pays with borrowed money. You make a profit without using a penny of your own money. It's really clever, isn't it? Maybe clever, but it's an illusion. The article ended by saying something like the whole worldwide financial system is an elaborate web of imaginary values tied together with non-existent expectations. As long as everyone keeps his mouth shut and plays the game, there's profit, enormous profit. The sky's literally the limit. But at a certain moment, one of these imaginary values turns out to be less than the bank says, a lot less. And then there are not just a few of these subprime mortgages, but hundreds, thousands, millions. Other countries have invested billions in these global transactions in thin air. Did you notice that in the last 8 years we've lost the world million? Everything now is counted in billions. Pretty soon it will be in trillions. For Americans, a trillion is a million million, a one with 12 zeros. The second big thing that is happening, of course, is the election. That, too, seems more and more spun of cobweb than thin words than that rarely meets much anymore. To tell the truth, my truth, I don't know who these people are anymore who so desperately want to be president and vice president of this country that, as I see it, is in more trouble than it ever has been in its short 200 and some years. This candidate is for the way things are. But tomorrow he says, no, the way things are is wrong. The other one moves to the middle when there's really no middle to move to. The whole equation has moved so far to the right as to be almost off the board. I decided we cannot go on this way. Soon we have to touch ground, feel the real earth under our feet. We cannot live in the upper layers of the atmosphere where all these glorious ideas and gambles are happening, where nobody can see them or even know what it's all about. The only thing I can think of is to be utterly honest. I cannot lie even to myself, certainly not to you. I don't like what those who supposedly represent me have allowed to be done in my name. I never wanted any war, not even against terror. That's another of those air words, war against terror. How can you make war with $3 trillion worth of airplanes, bombs, people, Humvees, tons and tons of oil against an idea? And it seems terribly evident to me that my government has many more hidden agendas. We almost certainly, I think, want our hands on what oil there is to be had when China and India start demanding more and more oil for their exploding economies. That is today, actually not a future. I'm appalled by our callousness here and elsewhere. Are we proud of being the nation with the most citizens in prison? Do we think we're wonderful when we execute people who are even perhaps we're innocent? How do we make it feel right to torture anyone, friend or foe? After half a century of carefully establishing a worldwide and world-accepted system of justice, we throw it all away without so much as an explanation. What did we allow to be done in our name? We can't go on like this. Of course we can't. But the problem, or problems, are way over my head. I cannot understand the airy-fairy of modern capitalism. What's $1 billion? Why would someone who has somehow gotten his hands on $1 billion want to invest or earn more? If he just stuck it under his mattress, buried it under a rock, he can take out $1 million a year for 1,000 years, or $10 million a year for 100 years. And who lives that long? I'm sure you can live on $1 million a year, tax-free. It's not earned nor invested. I'm sure you can do it very, very well. And I'm confused by the ferocity of a man not that much younger than I, who talks angrily in a soft voice, words that are all over the map, but when you look at them, they really mean almost nothing at all. What does conservative mean to politicians? All I can connect to the word, as it is used by American politicians, is that they are against beliefs and individual behaviors that have nothing to do with what I think is the function of government. Against gay marriage, abortion, against Islam but for Christianity, against socialism, which they seem to define as caring for poor people. Therefore, the flag, of course, the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, everybody must have some guns. Therefore, the death sentence. But then this candidate says he's not in this for himself, but for us. How? What? Who? And his running mate, who would be the famous one heartbeat from the presidency, is against pork, although she's done miracles getting pork for her projects. Millions, many millions of dollars. They must be lying, but they do it with such enthusiasm that the media repeat and repeat, and some of us must think, what do some of us think? Or do we think at all? The other day I met someone I sort of know, but not well. She squinted in the sun and said, you know that other guy, he scares me. Scares you? Why? He seems like a likable guy, nice family, has done some really good things I can relate to. And I thought, but not say, he's mixed, as the majority of humans are today. Instead, I stammered, how are you scared? Well, she could not really find the words. Finally, she sort of burst out, can you imagine her in the White House? Who, the Veep? No, the other, the whispering. She's black. I wanted to step back at least a foot, but controlled myself. You have to be nice in these situations. Yeah, she's black. You live in Hawaii. Surely you must be used to be seeing people of all colors. But a black in the White House? I suggested the White House could be painted a bright shade of blue with red trim. Later, when I could not get that brief exchange out of my head, I thought perhaps our problem starts with always having to be nice. One has to be nice with strangers, with people who don't know, the people you don't know, not trust or afraid of. We become so estranged of each other that we feel we must be very careful not to offend another, so we make them feel good. Salesmen talk nice. They're taught that, even though they often aren't nice at all. They lie and cheat to get our business, and although we know it is a thin veneer, we so desperately want to believe he or she is really nice, so he sells us insurance we cannot afford or need, a crazily overvalued mortgage with payments we both know I cannot meet. Then, always, someone says, but there are wonderful people in the world who do wonderful things. I don't doubt that for a minute. But what does that have to do with how I converse with a lady who's scared of a part black man? I would have liked to invite her to meet some black friends. After all, she tried to get me to come to her church. That time, too, I was nice and said I would think about it. She would be shocked if I told her what kind of spirituality I'm deeply immersed in. Nothing subversive, I assure you. I strongly believe, as the Native Americans believed, that we, humans, are just like other animals, part of nature, part of all there is. We're not better than other animals. I'm not even sure we're smarter. Oh, sure, we can imagine and then make things that never were made before, but what does that say about us? All it says is we can imagine. I have a phone call, and I'm going to hold off on taking it until I'm done with this article. Please be patient. That, I've come to the conclusion, is the only real difference between humans and other animals. We share the same chemistry, very much the same DNA. We breathe the same air. Life eats life. We do, animals do. We eat other animals to live. We eat plants that eat sunlight and air to process sunlight and air for us. The only difference that I can think of is that we can imagine things in our head that never were. We can imagine a financial system that is spun from imaginary gold in imaginary space with illusory values. We can imagine something we call democracy. We say it means one thing, but in fact it's something entirely different. We imagine good and bad that have little to do with my survival, but with ideas about how I and others ought to be. Once, half my lifetime ago, I met and got to know a small group of people who were primitive, surviving in the late middle 20th century. Not surviving very well because their jungle was being eaten up by modern government that had grandiose plans to plant millions of acres in rubber trees and oil palms. There was something about these people that got to me when I first met them. Here were people who were truly human, as all of us were once upon a time, without lies, without nice, without worries, without government, without hierarchy. Men were not better than or owners of women, who knew themselves part of nature. It took me a while to figure out that what I felt was a connection with my own deepest roots. This is what humans once were. They were nomads, meaning they didn't grow anything. They ate what grew around them, and when most of the food they liked was gone or not ripe yet, they moved on a few miles further into the jungle. They didn't own anything. After all, they must carry to a new location what they cannot do without, which for them meant they must find what they need at the new location. Bamboo grows everywhere in the tropics, and it makes a wonderful little hut on stilts, totally biodegradable. Less than a year after the people have moved on, you could barely tell there had been people living there. They knew nature intimately, of course. They knew it as well as their own bodies, because they and the plants, animals, trees around them were not different, simply different aspects of the same whole, a whole that is one. Once, a little girl who was leading me to a gathering through paths only she saw clearly, said, "You can't see the animals that are watching us, can you?" I admitted that I did not. "You will," she said. It took me many, many years, but now I do. The people didn't work. They spent their days in a dreamy walk, digging up a root here, plucking a ripe fruit there, singing little songs. They always left something of what they ate in the fork of a tree or on a branch. "Maybe someone else is hungry," they said, and the someone could be an animal as well as a human. They dreamed and learned from what fragments of dreams remained when they woke up. And they could not lie. Just think, nature cannot lie. Ask anyone who has ever been at sea in a small boat. Ask people who have experienced hurricanes, earthquakes. You cannot pretend the sun shines when it rains. The idea of saying something that was not true had never occurred to these gentle people. It would be literally unthinkable. Of course, they knew that I lived in another world, and I knew that they lived in their world. But for some reason, we accepted each other exactly as we were. And so they changed my life. Their life, I knew, was real. Utterly, totally real. The kind of real all primitive, some indigenous, very poor people all over the world know. We, who live in so-called civilization, have forgotten what real is. We live in illusion, a bad dream, slipping into a nightmare. Ever since I met who called themselves the people, I've attempted to live as they live. For those of you who have just tuned in, I'm reading a lengthy essay by a man named Robert Wolf. I'll proceed. Now I live with plants and animals that I love and know they love me. That sounds strange to a Westerner, but if you're around plants and animals, you know when a plant's happy, when its leaves are shining, it's growing, blooming, giving fruit. You know when animals are content. I know from deep in my heart and soul that unless we, the big we, all of us humans, we can only survive as a species if we somehow, some way, find the primitive soul in us that craves to be one with all there is. Not better, not worse, not even very different at all from all there is. Somehow we must learn to handle, deal with, that awkward ability we have to imagine. We think ourselves creators, but blind ourselves with how special we are, how different, how superior, better than, white better than colored, men better than women, young better than old, rich better than poor. Come on, people. We cannot be better than in a world where everything is connected to everything else, a planetary ecology. We imagine ourselves better, but look where that's gotten us. So here's my proposal. Let's imagine that we can no longer lie. Imagine that we can only think and talk what is evident. Imagine that we can very well do without an awful lot of things and practices we become accustomed to, even addicted to. I can grow vegetables here. I do well with that. And you, a few houses down the road, maybe make a shirt I can exchange for some vegetables. In my Aboriginal life, I know I'm in a neighborhood. There are not only plants, trees, animals, rocks, but also people around me. I can certainly include the ocean that's not far from here, and all around this island in my awareness of what is. But a government? Where did that imagination come from? A country? Who draws those lines? And then it gets out of hand. Industries that make things that nobody ever heard of before, but then we're told this is going to help us live better, or cheaper, or easier. And next year we can't do without it. Or we're told that we have to have a phone pasted to our ear 14 hours a day so we can... What exactly do we talk about? For quite a few years, we were told we absolutely needed a pickup. Well, a truck, really. And we could have four doors and five passengers and still have a truck bed pasted onto the back. Or we absolutely had to transport seven people, and they had to be entertained with DVD players for each of the two rows of seats behind the driver. And we needed an air-conditioned house with a minimum of four bedrooms and four bathrooms, or maybe five bathrooms, one outside. And the same people sold us on the idea that when you buy an acre of land, that land is yours to do with as you damn well please. But the developer clear-cut the land while subdividing it to sell it to you. And then you build a house, always facing the road, regardless of where the sun might be at noon when it's hot. The house, of course, has to obey the building codes from the state of New Hampshire, although this is Hawaii, and the island is officially in the tropics. None of that can be in my world. I've learned that clear-cutting so much land changes the weather here. We used to get much more rain than we do now. The weather people explained to me that green forest attracts rain, and flat, bright surfaces send rain clouds up and away. We used to think ourselves lucky to be on the rainy side of this island. Now we have a more or less drought. That's what civilization has done to our planet, the only one we have. That essay was by a man named Robert Wolfe, who lives on the Big Island of Hawaii, and it was published in opednews.com. Okay. This one's called How to Thwart Democracy. Okay, we've got a caller. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hey, Chamba, Ken.
Go ahead.
Hey, I've got a couple phone numbers for you. I liked what you had to say about that Section 8, but I think everyone should get a little more active politically and contact people.
Contact people?
I'm getting a double sound here. Okay. And contact people in Washington, which being Boxer and Feinstein. So I wanted to give you a couple of their phone numbers.
Okay.
And Boxer's phone number is 202-224-3553.
Okay.
Feinstein's number is 202-224-3841.
All right.
You know, political activism is really great, but we need to contact our representatives if we really want to get something done. So I would suggest all your listeners to give these senators a phone call.
Very good point. And since we can't take a point of view one way or the other, when you contact them, you can tell them you're in favor of the bailout or you're opposed to it.
Yeah, most definitely.
Okay, and the numbers are Boxer is 202-224-3553. Feinstein is 202-224-3841. Thanks very much for your call.
Thanks, Chuck.
All right. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Yes, hi.
Pardon?
Hello?
You're live on the radio.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was listening to...
Yeah, go ahead. You're
okay.
Live.
Okay, I'm sorry.
We're listening.
All right. Well, I wanted to give you the actual number of the debt that has incurred from the derivatives, because as we watch them and decide if $700 billion is enough for the bailout, the actual number is $1,144 trillion.
Okay.
And that is from the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, who
right.
keeps track of all the world's debts and assets.
Okay. Thank you for that figure. And as I reported earlier in this broadcast, It would probably help people to understand it more if that were broken down to how much each individual is responsible for.
Because I just think that it's ridiculous to think that the $700 billion bailout is going to help a number like that.
Nope. Absolutely right.
So thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR. And please turn your radio down because we can hear feedback.
Say, I'm wondering what or where can I find out about what would happen if there was no bailout?
That's a wonderful question, and I'm sure a lot of people have theories, but nobody knows for certain. But it's certainly an interesting alternative to what they're proposing.
And then the second question then would be is, I heard the FBI was investigating this financial problem.
Good luck.
Yeah, right. And so, but I'm wondering, what if these people who've been getting these billion-dollar, you know, very large bonuses,
mm-hmm.
while they're the people that they invest for have actually been losing money,
right?
More than just this last period,
right?
I wonder if it's possible to arrest these people and make them pay that money back.
Interesting idea.
To the American people.
Either that or pay their own investors who they advise so poorly.
Yes.
Interesting thought, and I don't know. But it would certainly be interesting to at least move in that direction. And I have an answer to your first question. What would happen if we didn't bail all these people out? Mm-hmm. That would be free market capitalism. Something that we talk about but do not practice.
Right. Would it really hurt the common people? The basic, quote, hardworking American?
Well, the theory is that the economy would crash and then the government would no longer be able to provide services and that would hurt the common people.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that's the theory.
I see.
You know, as I say, free market capitalism. Let them go. Let them fail.
What is it called when a bank can receive a dollar and then loan some
leverage? I think it's called leverage. They can loan it's at least six times as much as they receive in.
Uh-huh.
Or margin. I'm not sure what the words are. I shouldn't say because it's not my expertise.
Okay.
But yes, there is a system where a bank is allowed to loan considerably more than they actually have in assets.
Right.
And that creates the house of cards right there.
Yeah, I was thinking that sounds like the essential...
It is. It's the essential scam.
Undercut.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's the essential scam. Great system if you're on the right side of it.
Right.
Okay, we've
Thanks.
Got lots of other callers.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hey, Shabba.
You're live on KVMR.
Yeah, Shabba, you know, your idea of expressing the federal debt as a percentage of each citizen's amount?
Yeah.
That would be great, and if they'd also add the point, if we could send them a check like now and say, okay, we're paid up. From now on, we're not responsible for anymore.
Terrific idea.
That would work? Okay.
Okay, thanks for your call. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on the air.
Yeah, Chamba, in the spirit of one of your previous callers, Nancy Pelosi is taking comments on the bailout at area code 202-225-0100.
Let me write that down. Pelosi. Okay, give it to me again.
Okay, 202-225-0100.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay.
Bye.
It's your turn. You're live on the air.
Yeah, hello. Are you there?
You're live on the air.
Okay, I was suggesting just a minute ago that perhaps it's a good time to rebroadcast the Jekyll Island story. People might be a little more interested in listening to that sort of thing these days.
Oh, okay. I'll take that under advisement. Thank you for that suggestion.
You bet.
Caller, it's your turn. You're live on the air. We're almost out of time.
Hi, Chamba. You mentioned, you know, the bad thing about not bailing them out is that the government would shut down.
Right.
That's not my problem. I really think it would some kind of bailout has to happen. The Great Depression, I wouldn't like to see that again.
Okay.
Not that I saw it the first time.
Yeah, and you're probably going to see it again anyhow.
You might be right. Even the mainstream media, there's a good story in today's New York Times about when Sweden did this.
Mm-hmm.
The government bought the banks. They owned them.
Right.
After they bailed them out.
Right. Yep. And it worked. It was very successful.
Right.
Yep.
Good show. I'll see you.
Thank you. Caller, you're the last call. You're live on the air.
I appreciated getting the phone numbers for Boxer and Feinstein. Where could a person get the text of Paulson's bill? So if I call my newspaper, I can say, here's where you can read about it. Here's where you can check it out.
I don't know offhand, but you could certainly do a Google search for it.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing is the articles that I read gave the, it's Section 8 of that bill. The bill is very long.
Yeah.
The important part is Section 8. It's only 32 words.
Yeah, but, the, you know, like if I could give the editor that sentence.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah. The simplest answer I can give you is email me and I'll send it to you.
Okay.
All right?
Okay, because sometimes it takes a while for stuff to come up on your, and this is timely, so.
Right.
Okay.
Email me at chamba@kvmr.org.
Okay, thank you.
Okay?
Bye.
Yep. Okay. Well, we're out of time. I try to end with some humor, but we don't have time for it, and the calls are much more important.